time limit for diagnosis of surgeries in cancer patients. I think there are many subtleties in that. Thank you very much for the floor of the hearing. So over to you, Gerard.
Oh, I see. Okay, this is the order. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ted, and thank you, Peter. Thanks, everyone, for making it here in a very wintry night, actually. So I'll try to avoid obscuring the screen and perhaps spend most of the next hour around about here. So before I go any further, I would like to thank a range of colleagues who over the years, either by working together or by discussing and developing ideas together, are responsible for some of the content of this talk. As you can see, it's a multidisciplinary, of course, as ever, a multidisciplinary endeavor, including many statisticians, and I imagine there are a lot of you in the audience who are statisticians. Also, public health cancer registration and analysis colleagues. It's great that David is here today. I have learned a lot over the years and collaborated with many general practitioners who are working in research, and also a lot from psychologists and social scientists, including the late Professor Jane Wardle, who sadly passed away a few weeks ago. And I think there will be some echoes and some resonance of some of her theories and her work later on in the talk. Right, and before I start, I would also like to acknowledge that this is a very emotional, a very dear subject to many people, to a lot of us, and there have been a lay belief system about the importance and the causes of delays in diagnosis of cancer, and I fully acknowledge this, but my hope is that by the end of the talk, we will be a bit more well-informed from this, if you want, prior lay belief system, which actually is quite simplistic because it focuses on responsibility of the medical profession as opposed to actually many, many different factors in a complex problem. So there are going to be five main sort of subunits in the talk. First of all, a little bit about how early diagnosis has come about as a strategy for cancer prevention and control. Then a few conceptual or definitional issues about what is early or late diagnosis. A very brief discussion about whether it matters and why. Then there is a lot of slides, which is, if you want, the main empirical part of the lecture. And also quite a lot of speculation and suggestions about where things can go in the coming years. Right. So first of all, cancer and its importance for population health. That may be a bit basic for some of you, but I think it's important to cover this. And also early diagnosis and prevention and control strategy. So for anybody who needs reminding or educating about this, cancer is the principal cause of death in developed countries for the last few years. It has exceeded cardiovascular disease a few years ago in the US. And this is quite a nice slide. It's all US data. It's nice not only because it indicates that cancer is now the dominant cause of death, but because of the amazing success in controlling mortality from cardiovascular diseases like heart disease and stroke. And you see that the cancer curve is much more stubborn. This is not only the case in the US, but it's also in the UK. This is some kind of different metric, but essentially it's, again, mortality. And you see that cancer has exceeded as the principal cause of avoidable mortality, has surpassed cardiovascular disease in about the mid-90s. And I think something that is not quite on the slide, but you can also infer that the fact that whatever works for cardiovascular disease mortality clearly doesn't work as effectively for cancer. Otherwise, you wouldn't be seeing what you see. And I think that's the introduction to to a slide here and subsequently. So we have to think about, since there is a big problem about cancer mortality, what can somebody do? There are four main approaches, which you see here. So we can reduce mortality by preventing disease from ever occurring, but we can also reduce mortality from cancer by improving the survival of the cases. And that is quite, a multifaceted approach, which includes screening people at an asymptomatic stage, diagnosing patients with symptoms earlier on in their development of the illness, and of course improving treatments. None of these strategies is very effective on its own. So take, for example, primary prevention. We all like primary prevention, for sure, and it has been extremely effective, and it can still be even more effective than it has been when it comes to preventing things, diseases like adult onset diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and so on. 95% of cardiovascular disease is preventable by eliminating exposure of the population to lifestyle and environmental factors, smoking, controlling hypertension, lowering lipids. And this has been going very well, as you have seen in the previous graphs, for the last 40 years. This is not the case for cancer. So the cancer is more of an intrinsic kind of development as people age. It's kind of inherent into the aging process. There is a lot of cancer that is preventable, but it's not as if it's the majority of cases. So Max Parkin, he had done the sums on this one, and he published a supplement in the British Journal of Cancer in 2011. And these are people who spent all their lives about preventing cancer and finding out about etiological risk factors. So if anything, they are biased towards inflating the proportion of attributable fraction that is due to lifestyle and other risk factors. And they only came up with 45 to 45%, of which smoking is about 20 to 25%. There is also the problem of lack. Okay, so if magically everybody was to stop smoking, stop harmful drinking, if we were to eliminate pollution, if women and our daughters were to acquire the reproductive patterns of which were, 40 years ago and have childbearing at the age of 18, even if all these factors were to be eliminated, and some of those we don't want to eliminate because there will be sort of regressive steps as opposed to promoting welfare and well-being in the society. We would still have to wait some time until we harvest the goods. Mesothelioma is a very good example of this. So the elimination of the exposure to the harmful risk factor of the population has been achieved in the mid-70s. And we still see cases until 2025. Sorry. Ted.
There is one issue in this which I think is probably important for your cancer study, which is the age distribution at which the disease perhaps is diagnosed or at which people die of it. Because cancer in particular can have a very long latency time. So if you die of something else, like cardiovascular disease at an earlier age, you would perhaps never be diagnosed with cancer. So the
So you're right. So this one is not age adjusted. Sorry, age standardized, but this one is. So that covers what you stated a little bit. So but you're right, we have more cancer because we don't have mortality from cardiovascular disease and people live longer. But even if you allow for age, you still have I suppose it's a cyclical argument. The more people are free of, the more the competing mortality risks are controlled, the more you will have prolongation of life expectancy and people. Yes, so I don't know. is this, have I answered your question?
Well, sort of. I mean, without being an expert, my view is that cancer risk is, so to speak, cumulative, because it depends on cumulative cell damage.
Yes, yeah.
So the longer you give, the longer you live, the more likely it is that irreparable cell damage will occur.
That's right.
And therefore, perhaps, I mean, the sort of comparison I had in mind was, shall we say, a comparison of death rates of people between 60 and 70 years of age now and 20 years ago from cancer, and similar for cardiovascular, to see to what extent the two causes are competing.
There are definitely competing causes of death. So, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't perhaps follow. I think you have a point, but I can't quite understand you that. I don't know if somebody else would like to help.
Maybe you could look at it from the other end, as you might say. But picking up your point that indeed it's cancers arise as a result of cumulative genetic damage. And because we know what mutation rates are typically, you can do a very simple sum. And the upshot of that is that when the happy day dawns, that we can all live to the age of 140, we'll all generate a cancer of some description.
Yes.
So it's kind of looking at it from the other end.
Yeah, well, I agree with that very strongly. And this is why, at best, you will eliminate 40-45% of what we know currently, because there will be the inherent risk. The biological inherent risk of developing cancer, independently of whether you have smoked or not, whether you have drunk or not, or whatever. Yes?
But from a causes point of view, that doesn't really matter. It doesn't, because the accumulation of genetic damage is the cause of the cancer in a direct sense. If you give it a helping hand by smoking or
yes.
whatever, then fine.
Yes.
It doesn't alter that.
So it's a helping hand. So the 40-45% is from the helping hand. And at max you can remove the influence of the helping hands, but you will still left with quite a lot of cancer. And remember, you won't be able to eliminate exposure of the population to all these risk factors tomorrow. And even if you were to do that tomorrow, you will still have cases accumulated in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. As happened with mesothelioma, very, very good example of the lagged benefit. Right. I mean, I won't go into details now, but screening, you know the limitations of screening. First of all, we don't have enough screening. I mean, they're not tests that are good for more than maximum 5 cancers currently, and we only have programs for 3. Of course, when you have screening programs, people don't know everybody who can benefit. There ends up, there are inequalities, there's overdiagnosis, and so on. Improving treatments, easy to say, and it is happening, and we do have an increasing pool of survivors because of modern treatments, and things are getting better, but it is expensive, it is toxic. So people with melanoma now, if you have advanced stage melanoma, you have 20-25% chance of longer term survival. But the cost currently is about £80,000 a year, and there is about 20-25% risk of serious sort of side effects. So advanced cancer may be livable, but at an expense. So I think we need to combine all of them. I was reading a book from the WHO from about 2001, and it was about cancer prevention and control, and it was saying you can basically you can do prevention for cancer prevention control, you can do increase the quality of treatment, and you can do screening. So early diagnosis of the symptomatic patient wasn't there. So it's quite a new thing, and I mean the cynics will say it's a little bit out of desperation with the very slow advances in screening, in treatments, and in prevention, that it has been thought as a good idea, but it certainly caught up as a distinct strategy for reducing cancer mortality particularly in England and in some other countries like Denmark. But increasingly there are regions of the world and programs, and I would say countries, who incorporate the earlier diagnosis of symptomatic patients into their armamentarium. So,
can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Between early diagnosis symptomatic and early diagnosis asymptomatic?
Yeah, it's exactly, it's a good question. The two come from the same, if you want, motherboard, i.e. you have, cancer is a disease of multiplication of cells, therefore it's a time-dependent process. But there is the threshold of clinical disease that once it's exceeded, somebody has symptoms, and there is subclinical disease, which is the subject of screening.
Because you can have patients with a family history.
Yeah.
Of, say, breast cancer. So
yes.
They're not symptomatic, so they're asymptomatic, but they are at a higher risk of having a genetic mutation, say,
yeah.
A BRCA1 mutation. So you can have early diagnosis that's asymptomatic, so the patient does have a genetic mutation, but it's just not because of family history. So therefore, early diagnosis would apply.
Yeah, the concept is the same, you're right. Here, I would, for the economy of, but the two problems are substantially different, although they relate conceptually. And in terms of interventions and in terms of what can be done about screening for early detection in the symptomatic patients, the two separate quite a lot. So you're absolutely right. The time dependency of the neoplastic process is what drives, what supports both approaches. But how they express themselves in the real world as interventions, as tests, as a problem is completely different. So that's why we separated.
Yeah, I mean the key difference is obviously asymptomatic. You're wasting a lot of resources screening people who are never going to get anything. And whereas symptomatic, it can often be too low. So it's too.
Yeah,
just very distinct. Now, the risk models, which are asymptomatic risk models, which include family history and so on, and age and lifestyle. But when you start, there are models including symptoms, whether you know lung cancer, we go and cough and so on. And we find ones rather early, ones rather late. They each have their really distinct set of drawbacks.
Yes. So that's one of the many differences. But genetically informed screening might be a bridge.
It, actually. Yeah, it's a bridge.
Towards, you know, it enriches the population at risk. Okay, right. Now some definitional. This is still. I don't want to complicate matters, but I thought it's important to sort of visit this a little bit. So basically, there is a. You won't be surprised, there is a plethora of definitions and incarnations, if you want, of the problem. And all the things you see here have been bragged about by scientists, by politicians, by doctors and the media as manifestations of late diagnosis. For example, diagnosis of cancer in NIV, which is emergency diagnosis. The number of pre-referral consultations, more of that in a second. Prolonged primary care intervals, that's a bit technical, we'll come to that in a second. Having low awareness of symptoms, so having fatalistic beliefs, that's a marker perhaps of delayed help seeking, therefore a marker of prolonged patient interval. Again, we'll come to that in a second. But so there is a bit of sort of heterogeneity and confusion. And I think one way to consider this in a more taxonomically, if you want, linear way, is to consider two different families of measures and markers of diagnostic timeliness in the symptomatic patients. And one is, one family is the pure measures, I call them, because they're dealing with a quantity of direct interest, which is timeliness, which are the ones you see here. So patient interval, symptom onsets until they seek help, primary care interval, first presentation until an investigation or a referral has been made, and the secondary care interval is what happens once the first doctor has seen the patient and made the referral. And then you have some outcome measures, like the stage of diagnosis, stage being how big essentially the tumor is at the diagnosis level, it's a time-dependent process, but it's also highly influenced by the propensity of the cancer, the malignant propensity of the cancer. Being diagnosed as an emergency is a marker of having advanced stage disease. And although it's not a one-for-one relationship, there is, I think, you know, you can say it's a marker of late diagnosis. It certainly has been used very much like that. And short-term survival is has been certainly in the literature been used as a marker of late diagnosis when you want to measure late diagnosis in the populations. I think it's debatable whether it is a true marker of late diagnosis or simply something going wrong with the treatment. But I see, David, you don't like this. It's basically more describing the literature rather than taking a view here. And perhaps the better of the two families to go for the next few minutes is the pure measures, the time interval measures, which a consensus group of about 20 authors have kind of canonized 3 years ago in a paper in the British Journal of Cancer. This is the so-called Aarhus statement, because the first meeting of that group was in Aarhus in Denmark. It's not rocket science, but it's nice that they have put it together, and they each one of these boxes have a very clear definition. And most of the talk later on will be about the patient interval and the primary care interval. And again, the patient interval is symptom onset, the first relevant symptom that retrospectively somebody can attribute to the cancer until they have sought help, and the primary care interval from the day they presented until something was done. Some investigative or referral action was taken. We have a colleague in here in Cambridge called Fiona Walter. She's a primary care doctor, and she will also split the patient interval into two sub-intervals, which is the appraisal interval and the help seeking. So the appraisal interval is when you think something is wrong with you, but you're still haven't you know, perhaps you made some inferences that are not promoting of help seeking. For example, you have a change in the skin which you don't quite think it's going to be anything serious, and you attribute it to something else, you normalize it, and you delay help seeking until it changes very much or until it becomes bothersome. Or the same thing, you have an ulcer in your mouth and you appraise it. So they have done very good studies in this, actually, that people take some time, sometimes months, until they make the right inference about the body change. So the patient interval can have an appraisal interval component and also then a help-seeking component, which is the issue. You know, some people may delay for 2-3 weeks simply because they're on holidays or because they're very busy or because there's limited access in the practice. Okay, now importantly, we need to consider some surrogate markers of these two intervals. So I would say that, I mean, based on empirical work which we have done, the number of times somebody has seen the GP, these are people with subsequent diagnosis of cancer, and if you look back at their experience of presentation, if they have seen a doctor, the same doctor or another doctor, more than once for the same complex of symptoms that are relevant to their cancer, that correlates quite well with the primary care interval. Remember, a lot of people only have one consultation, and more of that in a second, but some people have multiple consultations. And the patient intervals, we have reasons to believe that the awareness, the knowledge about cancer symptoms, and the beliefs of the patient about the curability of the cancer, and also attitudes towards, for example, social responsibility for the healthcare system, and whether people might be bothering doctors unnecessarily and wasting their time. So a complex of socio-cultural constructs may influence the patient interval. So when you see awareness, beliefs, attitudes, it's, you know, different psychosocial constructs which interfere with how quickly patients seek help.
Again, beneath the surface of this, there is an issue which you could perhaps describe as patients' own prior beliefs, mm-hmm. in almost a Bayesian sense.
Yes.
And taking your example of mouth ulcers, some people are prone to mouth ulcers, and they are aware either from experience or from knowledge of other people that a typical non-dangerous mouth ulcer will be unpleasant for, say, a few weeks, but then will clear up.
Yeah.
And it is only when it has lasted well beyond their belief about, say, 3 weeks, that they will say, that shouldn't be happening. This time I saw the doctor. And that will be based on objective either personal experience or community knowledge, so to speak.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't quite fit into what you described regarding patients' beliefs. It's a category of belief, but it is sort of kind of scientific. It has an objectivity.
Yes, I see what you mean, Dave. I think there are two levels to these mechanisms of interpretation and appraisal. One is the one you mentioned, which should be common to everyone. But then
it
there are.
Be, but not necessarily.
Let's okay, but it's a distinct level. And then you have some additional another level, which you know, some people are very fatalistic about life, or are fatalistic about cancer, or there is some stigma or fear of cancer in particular. Which come and are superimposed to, if you want, to your Bayesian level. The big people will obviously make sense of symptoms that occur, that they have experienced before in their lives differently to completely new symptoms. Right, so a bit of, we're going into the empirical part of the talk now. So does early diagnosis matter and why? Actually, before we go any further, what do you guys think? I mean, this is symptomatic patients. So, do you think it matters for clinical outcomes? I mean, people have thought about this before? I don't know.
If it's a valid diagnosis, it's sooner or later.
Yeah.
The problem with early diagnosis is it's probably based on vague symptoms or signs, and you may get a false positive.
Uh-huh.
More likely to get a false positive, or it may be omitted, may be missed altogether.
Yeah. Okay, because there's also, I don't know, does Matt want to answer something?
I'd probably say it depends on the cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you mean some cancers you can afford the delay without much consequence, is that right?
Well, I would say, like prostate probably.
Improvement by early diagnosis, and others you can't.
Yes. Yeah.
So I just think about ovarian cancer because I've done too much work on that in the past.
Yeah.
I think if you've got a high-grade serous carcinoma, I'm not really sure your outcome's going to improve that much if you're diagnosed at stage 3.
Yeah, I think you're both saying the same thing.
Yeah.
I suppose the flip side of this is that some cancers are slow-growing. 1 month might not matter so greatly. Yeah, so the sad thing is that there's also a lot of heterogeneity within a site. So it's actually very difficult to know for the specific patients whether they would have had a better chance if their cancer was, you know, diagnosed 1 month earlier, provided they were symptomatic in that month, or later. But on average, I think my belief is that it matters, but for some patients, and probably it's a minority, and probably it's a discontinuous effect. It's not like as if the risk, everybody is exposed to the same risk uniformly. It's just there's some discontinuity. I don't want to be honest with you, unless you guys would like to discuss this either now or later, I don't want to go too much deeply into this. But I just wanted to propose a little schema. So there is a core argument which is about improving clinical outcomes for at least some patients, but not for everyone. So not everyone will be harmed by delay, but some people will. We don't quite know how many. And of course it will vary different circumstances, different level of different length of delay, and by size and so on. But there are other some more practical arguments, which I think are very real. Actually, they're not, you know, they don't have to be as hard outcomes as survival, but they do matter. You know, decreasing medical legal complaints to the profession and to the NHS. Efficiency and cost effectiveness. For sure, it's if somebody does have cancer, it's better to avoid sort of repeat revolving door episodes and having too many tests unnecessarily, or it doesn't make sense. And of course, improving patient experience. So people like early diagnosis for perhaps many reasons. Perhaps it's human nature. Perhaps it's also socially constructed preferences for having confidence and trust in good diagnosticians. And like, I think humans are programmed to want the any, you know, professional people in authority to be behaving with some sort of level of perfection, if you want. That's sort of the norm that is ingrained in our heads. So we were recently able to examine some of this empirically by looking at the satisfaction levels that patients who have experienced a delayed diagnosis were reported compared to patients who did not experience a delay. So the measure of delay in this data is the number of times that they have seen a doctor with symptoms related to their cancer until an investigative or referral action has been taken. And it's a very simple measure because it's dichotomized. Either people have seen a doctor once or twice, which is the flat line, one, or they had seen the doctor three or more times. And what you see in the vertical is their odds of a negative evaluation of their subsequent care. So this is using a questionnaire survey, which is called the Cancer Patient Experience Survey, which is run every year. Everybody who's a respondent here has had cancer. Okay? So they're all cancer patients. And the data are case mix adjusted for age, for sex, for ethnicity, for deprivation, and for cancer diagnosis. So they're quite well netted kind of effects, which relate to the exposure of interest, which is to the outcome of interest, to the exposure of interest, which is whether they have seen the doctor many times or a few times. So you see that by and large, for questions that have to do with evaluation and satisfaction, there is an association, and people who have been experiencing delay, they are more critical of their subsequent care. There are also a cluster of questions that are report questions, like how long have you had to wait to see the doctor? Okay, so you wouldn't expect a priori, you wouldn't expect people who have had a delay sort of 3 months ago to be experiencing longer waiting times in an outpatient setting three months down the line when they are treated in a hospital that has nothing to do with the primary care practice that they were in. And you see that for report questions, there is, for the three of the four, there's practically no effect. So a bit more observations here. The outcomes, the aspects of subsequent experience of cancer care where the delayed patients appear to be most dissatisfied are the ones that have to do with subsequent care by their general practice or by processes of care where the general practice was involved. So how satisfied they were with practice staff support after the diagnosis of cancer and after the discharge from hospital. Big effect size in terms of being predisposed to have a negative evaluation. Cancer care integration between the hospital and the primary care and community services, the second biggest effect size. Overall care satisfaction with all the services, including primary care, the third one. And the odd one of the report questions that I just mentioned, perhaps by some sort of leakage about mistrust to primary care, is the information given to GP. This is information given to GP by the hospital. But nonetheless, I think people misread the question and they kind of express some sort of dissatisfaction about the primary care service. So basically, yes.
Check as to which way up this is. A high value of the odds ratio, is that a bad outcome?
Yeah, it is a higher chance, a higher odd of having given a negative having had a negative experience.
Okay, thank you.
Now you can say, how big is this? Well, actually, if you look at the percentage scale, it's between sort of it's between 2 and 9 percentage points of less satisfied. Okay, and again, you can ask, how big is that? Is it very important? Who knows? I mean, there is no external standard. There is no hard and fast rule about how, you know, what is the level of dissatisfaction that is important. But it's certainly, you know, something to be taken care of and supports the prior understanding that people do appreciate timely diagnosis. Okay, now, a lot more data coming. This is now an overview of some epidemiological studies about the number of pre-referral consultations, about the length of the patient interval, and about stage of diagnosis. So first of all, data about the primary care interval and the number of pre-referral consultations. So this is data from a so far not repeated, so far unique study of the primary care, of the diagnosis of cancer in primary care. It's called the National Audit of Cancer Diagnosis in Primary Care. The patients were incident cases of cancer who were diagnosed in 2009 and 10. There are about 18,000 cases, and doctors in about 1,200 practices or nurses, they extracted data from the medical records of these patients. And they found that the number of pre-referral consultations, oh, by the way, forgive me, they have excluded screening-detected cases. So these are all symptomatic patients, okay? And they have found that the distribution of number of pre-referral consultations is as you see here. So first of all, you know, nearly 6 out of 10, the suspicion of diagnosis of cancer is done, if you want, instantly. Second consultation occurs in about a quarter. Second consultation is important, and it's very difficult to adjudicate whether it's a delay or whether it's part of the optimal care, timely care package, because a lot of people have a test, be it a urine culture or a blood test or even a chest x-ray. And so people tend to consider first consultation and second consultation as one, which is essentially one episode of care. And then 3, 4, 5 plus, as you see here. Now, let's consider this another way. The sensitivity of up to 2 consultations with a general practitioner, back in 2009-10 at least, it make a change now, and it has got even higher, of diagnosing, that means suspecting a diagnosis of cancer, is 82%. That's actually very high. If you consider it with, for example, chest x-ray for lung cancer. Does anybody happen to know what is the sensitivity of chest x-ray for lung cancer?
75%.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, something like that. So it's, you know, and many other tests are, you know, have different levels. You know, 70% is, so FOB, fecal occult blood testing for colorectal cancer, 50%. So actually 82% is very high. Depends, of course, how you see life in general and whether this is half full or half empty, but I think it's much more half full than half empty. Nonetheless, there is a non-ignorable proportion of patients who do experience delay. What can be done about this? I think before we consider this, just again, this is one way, one that was discovered, which is back in 2011, it was actually much less common than the general people would have thought of. And very importantly, I think this is too high a proportion to be down to rogue professional practice. What do I mean by, why I say suggest this, and what do I mean by that? When you have deviant behavior in any group of professionals, basically, you have a 1%, a 2%, of cases that go wrong. I mean, take an extreme example, wrong side surgery. Okay, so when you have imperfect professional performance or imperfect system performance, this is not something that happens often. It's something very, very uncommon. When in a healthcare system things happen commonly, it's usually not because of individual level kind of issues. It's because the whole system is, or if you want, the level of scientific knowledge even, is not mature enough to prevent these events from occurring. I don't know if I took you with me on this one, but bear with me if not. Now, we discussed that, the 80-20, so 80% once or twice, and 20% 3+. That is the average. When you look at it by cancer, it's very variable. So this is a collection of 15 cancers, and the question here and the outcome is again the same. How many times have these patients have seen their GP before they were referred? And remember, again, these are patients with cancer. So you see at one end of the spectrum, in a way, multiple myeloma and pancreatic cancer, and at the other end, melanoma and breast cancer. And in between, you have a few other cancers. Now, the people who haven't seen this before, could you sort of fathom what's going on here? Very large variation. It's certainly not the case because the doctors...
Well, it's harder to diagnose, is it?
Yes.
A suggestion of, as it were, difficulty of diagnosis, yeah, or difficulty of detection.
Great, yeah, exactly.
Variation of that over the types of cancer.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. So the symptom signature here is very adverse. Why? Because, for example, multiple myeloma, 50% of the patients present with musculoskeletal pain, including back pain. Very low predictive value. You were talking about that earlier. Pancreatic cancer, 50% have abdominal pain. There are some patients with pancreatic cancer who will come in jaundiced, and that will be a telltale sign when something is very seriously wrong. But it will be like 3 or 5% of all pancreatic cancer patients. The early symptoms are not so dramatic, so red flag. On the other hand, breast and melanoma, 95% of the patients will have an abnormal skin lesion. In breast, it will be like 90% will have a breast lump or other breast lesions like inverted nipple or discharge or skin changes on the breast. So this is a measure of diagnostic difficulty, the measure of how the symptom signature is adverse or enabling. This kind of evidence wasn't known. I mean, until we had the audit, which was done in 2009 and 10, and until we had the patient experience survey, these are the two sources of data in this graph, that we kind of understood this. And now there is evidence from other countries that are emulating this experience of measuring best experience that is quite concordant. A key question here is what would have been the case if it was 2000 or 1990? Would it have been the case that, we don't know, but that's speculation. Would it have been the case that this sort of oblique line would have been a bit flatter? And you would have had melanoma and breast being higher to where they are now, and perhaps we're winning the battle. I don't know. We do aim to track this phenomena longitudinally in subsequent surveys. Now, that was the slide I was looking for. Symptom specificity or predictive value. So that, just to remind everyone, or rather to show you this with data, I mentioned earlier that the number of consultations does correlate to the primary care interval, which is the primary, the measure of primary interest, and there is some data to show this. So 5+ consultations, the average delay was 3+ months. Important to know that there is a 10%, a 5% of the patients who actually wait much longer than the average. Okay. So, two themes that we discussed already, but please bear them in your mind for the rest of the slides. Variation in the primary care interval chiefly reflects our limitations in diagnosing common symptoms with poor specificity for cancer. There are no good point of care tests, basically, although this might change in the next 5-10 years. And appreciating variation in diagnostic difficulty could inform different strategies for improvement. Now, there is also variability by socio-demographic group in diagnostic difficulty and the experience of multiple consultations. Okay, so this is the same data, more or less, but instead of looking by in terms of percentage of 3+ by cancer, you look at odds ratios of 3+ consultations by socio-demographic group. So what do you see here? You see that women have a slightly higher risk of 3+ consultations compared to men. All other things being equal, this is adjusted for cancer and adjusted for all the variables you see on this graphic. And the younger the person is, again, the higher the chance of 3+ consultations. So what's going on? Similar phenomena. So the positive predictive value of symptoms, on a symptom-for-symptom basis, the positive predictive value of a given symptom for cancer will be much lower in younger patients and also in women. To give you an example, hematuria, blood in the pee, will have a predictive value all ages together for men of between 6 and 10%, and for women it would be like 3 to 6%. Okay? And similarly, on a symptom basis, and for patients of the same sex, the same symptom in the younger patients will have much lower predictive value. So, I coined the term epidemiological optimism. So, in looking at Ted's Bayesian approach, so doctors, of course, kind of internalize the prior risk of cancer in this person. So, it's not as if it is unjustifiable, or rather, it's not that it's unexplainable, but the question is whether we can do something about it. And there are interventions that are aiming to empower the decision-making and the psychology of decision-making by the doctor in order to perhaps more appropriately interpret symptoms when they are there. There is also a higher risk of multiple consultations if you are a cancer patient who belongs to an ethnic minority groups. We have done some analysis which might be enlightening here, which is looking at the interaction between ethnicity and age. So going back one slide, this is the average effect. So ethnic minority patients with cancer, all ages together. If you stratify this by age group, you see that the ethnic minority patients who are middle-aged and above, these are the ones who experience the higher level of multiple consultations. The younger patients have the same pre-consultation, pre-referral experience as the white patients, which perhaps points to issues with acculturation, either linguistic or in terms of etiquette of the consultation and norms of the consultation. So that is an easy one, hopefully, for further research and further interventions by providing other translation support or patient. The buzzword is patient activation or patient enfranchisement sort of interventions, like giving them leaflets to explain if they have pelvic symptoms, to be able to articulate that they have a checklist and they dig it and they give it to the doctor, for example. AIDS communication. I mean, a lot of this has to be further tested, but at least it gives you an area where further research and further initiatives can be targeted. Now, there is also an interesting interaction between cancer and gender. So you see here the average effect is one that women have a small excess risk of 3+ consultations on average. But if you stratify this by cancer, you see that for most cancers it's more or less the same, except for the two main urological cancers that can happen in other gender. And here you have a much higher, if you want, disadvantage in being a woman. The risk of having C-plus mutations is much higher for women with bladder cancer compared to men with bladder cancer, and the same for renal. And here we have done another study about this, which indicates that the median delay for women is about 30 days, and for men is about 15 days. The mechanism here again is the higher or lower PPV of hematuria. Women, for biological reasons, have a much higher chance of urinary tract infections, which can also manifest with blood in the pee, and the positive predictive value is lower, and it makes the suspicion of diagnosis of cancer of the bladder or the kidney more difficult. Now, changing to patient interval. Okay, you have all seen the campaigns that aim to shorten the patient interval. They're called Be Clear on Cancer campaigns. Before that, they've been breast awareness campaigns or melanoma skin awareness campaigns. I mean, what they try to do is to minimize the number of days that people take to appraise and seek help, appraise their symptoms and seek help. How to measure the patient interval is actually very difficult. You can ask the patients, so you can interview them or questionnaire them, but these patients will be a biased sample of everyone in the population. They will be the most educated and the less severe disease kind of patients. People have done it and they have documented it, but it has generalizability limitations. You can also look at the consultation records of large populations of patients. The good thing there is that you don't discriminate, you don't select anyone, you see everybody who came through the door, but of course you rely on the completeness and the quality of the medical records. But so there are pros and cons in other solutions, in other approach, but some data from using this approach, okay? So here is trained people like clinicians or nurses looking at the records. And in every consultation, there is a elicitation of how long people have had a problem, okay? So this is the contract of medical consultation since Hippocratic times. The doctor will either be given the information or will ask the information, how long do you have this? The question is how often and how accurately this is transcribed. But anyhow, right, so using this method, so people looking at the records and Scottish data, first of all, published in 2009. So this is the number of days from the trigger, reported trigger symptom until they saw the GP. So what you see is for bladder and other urological, which is kidney, it's 2 days, and for head and neck it's 30 days. Melanoma is 25 days. So you already get an idea. If the symptom is very dramatic, very sudden, like blood in the pee, people may take notice very quickly. If it's something like, we already covered this already, oral ulceration or skin lesion, not necessarily dramatic, not necessarily bothersome instantly, although it may be worrisome, but it's not very bothersome, people may take time and may normalize. So that was the Scottish data, and then English data, which is from the National Audit of Cancer Diagnosis and Primary Care. This is 18 cancers as opposed to 12 cancers, which were in the Scottish audit. And you see some very similar patterns. The more insidious symptomatology cancers on the right-hand side, the more sudden symptoms on the left-hand side. So how does this tally with prior theory? This is a famous study by Jane Wardle and colleagues. So Katie Robb is the first author. So you see that the cancers on the right-hand side, which were esophageal and oropharyngeal, they are characterized by oropharyngeal is characterized by ulceration in 60-70% of the cases in the mouth, and esophageal by dysphagia, difficulty swallowing. And you see that these are the two of the nine symptoms where the spontaneous recall of their likely association with cancer in the general public is lower. So I think that tallies very well, although of course there are different samples, different sort of populations, but it certainly makes a case for public health education campaigns about these two symptoms. Now, some data that we have, some work we've done with David Greenberg. And it's all about combining evidence from different streams of work. So we looked at stage of diagnosis. Stage, all things being equal, is a measure of diagnostic timeliness. And first of all, for 10 different cancers, but I would like us to focus on the three cancers on the right-hand side, breast, endometrial, and melanoma. So these are cancers where more deprived patients, women with breast and endometrial, and men or women with melanoma, the poorer patients basically have a higher risk of advanced stage of diagnosis. The same is also more or less true for the same three cancers for older age. By that we mean 65 plus and 70, 74, 75 plus, and so on. Now, remember, these phenomena are concentrated in these cancers much more than other cancers. Forgive me. And these are the cancers, endometrial, melanoma, breast, that are associated with a minimal degree of post-presentation delay. So, incidentally, these are data adjusted for screening. Therefore, this strongly, see, the delay for endometrial, melanoma, and breast, the post-presentation delay is absolutely trivial. In spite of the trivial post-presentation delay for these three cancers, we have non-ignorable differentials in stage of diagnosis of the population by age and by deprivation, by socioeconomic status. So these data, combined with these data, strongly point the finger to the differences in the patient interval, difference in the length of the patient interval being responsible, and therefore the normalizing behaviors seem to be very socioeconomically and very even socially patterned by age group and socioeconomic status. That kind of sort of, I think, is logical, although there is no direct proof for this. But indirectly, you can infer it by looking at the data that I saw you. I don't know if anybody has a view on this one.
Is there an issue with smoking? So if you have higher smoking rates, well, you do have higher smoking rates, you have different groups. And is that correlated with more aggressive disease?
I don't think so. Yes, it's a good question. I don't think so. I think smoking is, or even if there is an association, it won't be that big, I don't think much. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, when I saw this, when we came up with this idea, that in a way we have sort of supported it in different fora, I think most people accept it. Anyhow, the point here is that it indicates that the non-ignorable part of the problem is actually in patient behavior, patient education, consultation patterns. It's, you know, at least for these easy to diagnose cancers, the battle, if you want, is in terms of eliminating how people deal with these symptoms when they come, independently of their age group, independently of their socioeconomic status. It's not a question of educating doctors. They have no problem in spotting these cancers. Okay? So where do we go from here? This is the last part. So there are only two questions of substance in this field: how to help the patient make the right decisions about themselves, and how to help the doctors make the right decisions about the patients once they have presented. One approach, and Matt is here, and there are some sort of queries about some of this data, but the concept is the right one. So we're trying to, this is a measure, this is one of the measures of early late diagnosis, emergency presentation, and we have stratified the risk of emergency presentation by age, sex, deprivation, and cancer. And there's a total of 2,000 strata here. And as you can see, the risk by age, which is what is portrayed here, varies quite substantially for different cancers. And by doing this kind of detailed profiling, you may find where your interventions, be it community interventions like public health education, or whether they are healthcare interventions, could be better targeted. The point here is one of an exemplar. Yes, Ted.
What is the basis of selection of the different groups of cancers for the different age groups? You have not listed the same cancers in 25-34 as in 35-44, for instance, and so on.
When there are some sparse data in some cells, and if these cells have very few cases.
Except it is all the same.
It is all the same, yeah. That's not a Y, that's not an X-axis. It's just a key. It's a key to the dots.
Yeah, but it's a key to age groups, isn't it?
Well, yeah, the coloured dots, yeah.
No, the columns.
No, the columns
are
the...
I thought what Ed is talking about, there's not 25-34 here.
The bottom doesn't relate to the
column,
to the lines above it.
It relates to the column dots. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Forget. Okay. Yes.
Oh, I see.
This could be this legend could have been up here.
Yeah.
So basically, what you see here,
it's
like
coincides with it. Actually.
So there's 27 cancers, and they are assembled in order of whether the association of by age is ascending or plateaued or descending. So basically you see that for ALL, well at least we believe, the younger you are, the younger you are, the higher the risk of virus presentation. Whereas for laryngeal, it's the opposite. The older you are, you have the higher risk. It's not quite apparent what you can do with this, but the examples, there are three or four examples in the paper where we kind of makes some sort of practical sense. The rest is really for discovery. By that, what I mean by that, we have another finding of the same paper where you always have an excess risk of marriage presentation if you are socioeconomically deprived, but this excess risk is particularly high if you have oral, again, or oropharyngeal cancer. Therefore, that gives you a measure of potential for improvement in terms of educating people from lower socioeconomic strata about oral ulceration, for example. So there's too much data here.
Just to comment, the people who are not familiar, you'll actually notice that two of the most common cancers, breast and prostate, aren't there at all because they don't appear as emergencies, hardly at all.
In fact, the reason is a bit more mundane than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can do
a central. Yeah. We hope to cover that gap. Okay. Stratification I think is a good wonderful idea. It has been hijacked by biological scientists, but in reality it can apply to population subgroups, and it's a useful framework here. When it comes to interventions, so I think there are possibly four types of interventions. New test development, clinical decision support during the consultation, clinical audit and root cause analysis, and improvements in the diagnostic process because it's a very complex and non-linear one. Some further examples or ideas. So if we segment cancers into harder, average, and easier to suspect, for these ones, you know, the symptoms signature is really adverse. But I believe the only way out here is the development of new, perhaps some sort of new application of all tests in the consultation or in a way that is easy, you know, point of care or near point of care testing. Incidentally, there has been some development, particularly for myeloma testing recently. And I believe you can sort of the way you dipstick urine, there is a dipstick for myeloma protein in the blood, and this is going undergoing clinical trials now, which would be very good news. How far we are from prime time, and how far are we from other tests of similar nature? I don't know. There is a great range of middle difficulty cancers. I think. There is no specific sort of preference there. I think any of these interventions could help. But we have a very interesting problem with the easy to suspect cancers. A proportion of those patients experience multiple consultations, and incidentally a proportion of those patients also experience emergency presentations, although as David said, it's only a minority. So only 2% of breast cancer, women with breast cancer, will experience an emergency presentation. But it's still not zero. So what's going on there? Why do we have this problem still? Is it because this is the absolute minimum that one could hope to have, because there will always going to be some patients with melanoma that present with metastatic disease, or some women with breast cancer that present with metastatic disease, therefore the symptom signature will be very difficult and so on. So we don't know, and this is where I think drilling down in some case studies and prospectively looking at concentrating a surveillance and improvement effort in these patients might pay dividends, because we can find out, you know, what is the limit of improvement there, and whether there is perhaps any rogue professional behavior, who knows. If there is any, it will be concentrated there. We're not too far from stratifying some of the public health armamentarium, so I'm sure you've seen this. Well, I don't know, you may have been exposed to it, like advertisement is a great invention, everybody sees them more or less, I don't know if they work. So the breast cancer awareness campaign is stratified to older women, not younger women, for many, because of a lot of pieces of evidence from many groups and many papers over the years, including data I show you. The big glial cancer campaign so far, they have included bladder and kidney cancer, but if you remember, I have shown you that these are the cancers where the patient interval is shortest. So perhaps on the basis of how long we think the patient interval is, they're not a priority sort of target, but they do not include dysphagia, or include it only in a minority form, and they don't include oral ulceration. And I think that is low-hanging fruit kind of ideas that can be taken forward. It's a very complex problem. There are variable sources of variation. When it comes to post-presentation variation, the specificity of symptoms and the prior risk of cancer in a stratum of patients can be very consequential. But psychosocial factors are also very important in predicting and explaining variation in the times of diagnosis for easy to suspect cancers. Now, the lay belief system which I started with, I hope I have provided enough evidence to sort of challenge this a little bit. It's actually, I would say 30% of the problem is patient behavior, and how can we empower patients to make the right decisions and to present. Maybe another 30% is how can we empower doctors to make the right decisions in the consultation space. And the other 40% is how to support the diagnostic process. It's of course very easy to, you know, if you're a politician, you want to have a very specific target, but reality is much more complex. Known unknowns, overdiagnosis. It cannot happen in a patient with cancer, but you can expose patients who don't have cancers into a lot of tests, and some harm can come out of that. Cost effectiveness, impact on other disease areas, hopefully beneficial. Forgive me. Can it be that we are making inequalities worse? Organizational variation, I'll just give you an example of that from a study that we're doing currently with colleagues. So the idea here is to find out variation in activity relating to diagnosis of cancer, and find out what predicts some of this variation. Is it real? And to the extent that it's real, what is there any clustering of organizational attributes in these practices which predisposes to high or low investigation rates. I talked about an integrated approach earlier on, and I truly believe this, although I specialize in the middle box here, you actually need help from all the approaches and all the strategies. And lastly, a lot of what, I mean, there's nothing particularly unique about the challenge of diagnosing cancer promptly in cancer. There are actually, diagnosing any disease is difficult often, because the symptoms for any disease have low predictive value, not only for cancer. So these are three examples. Ankylosing spondylitis. People are familiar with ankylosing spondylitis, a disease that occurs in young men mostly, and is associated with progressive stiffness of the spine. Very non-specific symptoms. What do you think is the... Oh yes, it says here. So it's fascinating. I mean, the interval to diagnosis for these patients, this is a patient survey of about 1,000 patients with ankylosing spondylitis in the UK. I showed this slide in the States without the solution, and I said, "What do you think it is?" And this is somebody said, "Oh, it's 8 years," and she was an American rheumatologist. And so basically, it's a global problem for this disease, and there are many other diseases like this. Because they're not cancer, they don't have, you know, Cancer Research UK, they're not the top cause of mortality, they don't get enough attention, but it's a manifestation of the same problem. The root problem is the low specificity of symptoms.
The case of the if every patient back pain, stiff back, muscle pain, balance, whatever, were X-ray.
Yeah, I don't
you
know.
You have a high probability of detecting the spondylitis or the ankylosis, whichever way you're looking at.
I don't know. Maybe not in early stages.
Is it not essentially a bone growth between vertebrae?
It's an inflammation of the ligaments of the spine. I think the test is a blood test, actually. It's an HLA B27.
It's more soft tissue cartilage,
yeah,
which is more difficult to detect on X-ray, I think, but I'm not sure.
And incidentally, same argument. I Carl Gaffney, he's a rheumatologist at Norfolk and Norwich. It so happened we were on a flight together. We did not know who everybody is, and we just started chatting to each other. And he told me about this study. This was about 2-3 years ago. A fascinating sort of flight journey. And he told me their community have exactly the same problems. Does it matter for clinical outcomes? Yes, it does. These are people who are young men usually. They have huge problems with settling into an occupational pattern. They take a lot of sick leave. Without being diagnosed, it destroys their employment record and their employment relationships. It also has some connotations to their general relationship and so on. And of course it matters for clinical outcomes, because the faster you are diagnosed, the faster you can get proper treatment, physiotherapy, and avoid symptoms. Anyhow, COPD should be very easy to spot, but there are missed opportunities. So what we need, I think, is, I mean, okay, cancer research is our field, but a broad coalition of funders and scientists to speed up progress in early diagnosis of any symptomatic disease. Very recently, the Institute of Medicine, which is like the NICE, but for America, produced this 412 pages guideline, which are not disease specific, and they talk a lot about the processes of diagnosis, of which a schematic you see here. You have these are boxes or intersections where things can go wrong in the complex diagnostic process, either the encounter level or the test performance level, and the communication of the results, or the follow-up when people, for example, don't show up, or an appointment invitation hasn't been sent by mistake, and so on. And you have patient factors, provider factors, that is doctors or nurses, and system factors operating at these three levels. if you're interested more about the theory behind all that, I mean, these are two papers we have written fairly recently, in the last 12 months, really. The first one is with Professor Jane Wall, who I mentioned earlier. And that's everything. And I'm really sorry, that took us a longer time than any academic sort of standard talks. But apparently, that's not the longest.
Well, we provoked you.
I wonder, could I perhaps ask whether out of the kind of epidemiological data that you talked about and other data, it's possible to extract a useful answer to a question that I guess should be fairly high on the agenda of most people who rely on the UK health service. And that is, why is it that we consistently lag significantly behind virtually every other developed country in terms of cancer survival rates?
I could talk about that for about 2 days.
Well, you're not the only one, but it's a very simple question. And I think the answer is probably no. But what would be very useful if the epidemiologists could find a way of coming up with it would be to be able to make a semi-quantitative assessment of where the problems are. And it seems to me that there are only really three places that they can reside in. Two of them are issues that you have talked about quite a lot. One is patients presenting late for the virus. The second one is that the majority of patients probably present to GPs, and so the issue of GP incompetence is a significant factor to be considered. And thirdly, of course, what happens subsequently in terms of treatment, and it's quite clear that if you look at what's become known as the postcode lottery, that's highly variable across the country. But what would be very useful would be, in terms of thinking what can we do and where should we direct our efforts, would be to make even a rough guesstimate of which of those are, what proportion of those contribute to our failure to keep up with countries that otherwise are equivalent to us.
Yeah, so it's a very good question. Before I answer as best as I can, yes, so David has been a co-author in a few of these papers.
One other point to perhaps throw into it is that survival time is measured from the time of diagnosis of the cancer, which is actually a pretty meaningless concept. They try and apply rules to it, but it's not necessarily consistent from country to country.
This is the fourth potential explanation. The other thing I wanted to say is you could invite one day Sarah Walter from the London School, who is actually a Cambridge resident, who is one of the people who have done the most recent wave of the ICBP studies. I believe she's available, and I can recommend her to you, Peter. She has made her career in the last 2-3 years publishing these papers from the International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership, a lot of which try to partition at least some of the problem into two major components: the diagnostic component, which they measure with stage of diagnosis, and they then stratify the survival differences by stage. And everything else. From their studies, and they have done this for 4 sites, the answer is that a variable proportion, but usually the majority, is due to things other than diagnosis. But the diagnosis measured in terms of differences in states at diagnosis may account up to a third of the overall survival difference. Now, going further than that, out of this one third, which is diagnosis, how much of it is before presentation, how much is after presentation, and of the two thirds that is treatments, how much of it is patient preferences or relative preferences for non-aggressive treatment, how much of it is regulatory regimens, which may be more enabling or less enabling of aggressive treatments. How much of it is surgery? That part we don't know. And there is an effort to create a subsequent wave of these studies called International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership 2. So far we had the one, to go further. But you instantly go into the issues that David has mentioned, which is comparability of data, completeness of data. Is the missingness mechanism the same? Are the conventions for registering date of diagnosis the same? Are the conventions for registering treatment the same? And sadly, these are very real issues. So I don't think there is an easy answer, unfortunately. But probably you knew that anyhow.
I knew that. I just thought you might have, come up with something on the train.
The best we know is this one-third, two-thirds from these four papers, which are the size
of the
papers.
I mean, the majority of the survival difference does occur within the first year, and after that it goes on. So probably early diagnosis, as you say, is involved, but quite the extent of it is very, very difficult to be absolute.
It is actually true that a very significant proportion of the discrepancy derives from post-diagnosis treatment, in fact.
Yes.
Then that's a very powerful argument for concentrating treatment in specialist centres, but a fewer in number.
Yes, of course.
It's an argument that's also going on in the cardiovascular field for precisely the same reasons. But it is kind of important, because it may be that that's really worth putting a lot of effort into.
I think that's right. I should also mention something else, perhaps a little bit more sociological. There is also some sort of prior, at least theory, that forget about stage 1, 2, 3, 4 disease and just concentrate on advanced stage management. Both the doctors and the patients may be differently predisposed to very aggressive I don't know if aggressive is the right term, it's certainly been used in the literature, to basically the degree of effort that is put into the treatment to a prolonging life. Okay, stage 4 disease, the cure is usually not an option, usually up until now, for most cancers, although things are changing. And then whether somebody whether a clinic has a particularly comprehensive sort of treatment regimen or a little bit like a hands-off regimen, this may add, quite a number of months in life, although not produce any cure, and that alone can be a big source of variability. So if you have stage 4 disease, median survival of 3 months for lung cancer, say in the UK, and 6 months in the US, this is a lot of patients, and they may dent the overall statistic very substantially. So some colleagues of ours in the States, they are suggesting that instead of doing overall comparisons, just compare the management and the survival of aggressive disease patients and see if that holds the key. And again, it comes back down to sociocultural constructs about what people should do when they have terminal illness. What's the trade of being quality of life, being with your family, or being in a hospital and in ICU? Anyhow.
Any further points or questions? I have to diagnose that the meeting is probably at an end. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Here you are. Thank you.